this episode of the Fisheries Podcast, I talk with Dr. Steve Sammons from the University of Auburn about his experience working with shoal bass in both Alabama and Georgia. Thank you for joining me. I am Nick Kramer, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter at FisheriesPod or on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast. Our guest today is Dr. Steven Sammons. Steve graduated with a bachelor's degree in fisheries science from Virginia Tech in 1991. He then went on to gain a master's degree from South Dakota State in 1993 and ultimately his PhD from Auburn in 2004. Steve describes himself as a classically trained fisheries management scientist who also now dabbles in conservation of large endemic fishes such as shoal bass, Alabama shad, and Gulf strain striped bass. His work typically lies at the intersection of management and ecology, attempting to bridge the gap between sensible conservation and sustainable management. His lab has been responsible for most of the research conducted on shoal bass, an endemic black bass in the Apalachicola Basin. And in 2017, he wrote the range-wide shoal bass management plan that outlines future conservation and restoration of this species. In his spare time, he currently serves as the fisheries editor for the Journal of the Southeastern Associated Fish and Wildlife Agencies. He is an avid angler and enjoys chasing the wide variety of stream-dwelling black bass that live in Alabama and Georgia. Welcome to the podcast, Steve.
Thank you for having me.
So we've had another guest from Auburn on the podcast to talk about red-eye bass, but you work with a different bass down there. What is it about the southeastern United States that makes it a black bass biodiversity hotspot?
Well, that's a great question. The southeast, of course, is not just a black bass diversity hotspot, but just a general biodiversity hotspot. There's not just also fish, but mussels and crayfish and reptiles and plants and pretty much the whole range of organisms on Earth. And my understanding is it has a lot to do with the age of this part of the country in geologic terms. We're well below the glacial line down here, and that has something to do with it. And of course, in this part of the Southeast in particular, you have a lot of river systems that all lie adjacent to each other that flow to different oceans. You know, right here in around Auburn, you have the rivers. Most of the rivers around here flow to the Gulf of Mexico, but not very far to the east of here. By the time you get to the middle part of Georgia, everything there flows to the Atlantic. And then in northern Alabama and a little sliver of Georgia, and of course in Tennessee, is the Tennessee River, which is actually part of the Ohio River drainage, which is actually part of the Mississippi River drainage. So that has to have some effect on it too in terms of fish. Alabama has 350 some species of freshwater fish. Tennessee has somewhere in the high 200s. So this is an area that has just quite a bit of diversity in general, and black bass follows right along that same trajectory. A lot of the species or the putative species that we have here tend to fall along drainage lines. You mentioned red-eye bass. Red-eye bass are the most notorious ones probably of this. If every one of the proposed species actually is a species, then you literally have one species per drainage, starting from the Savannah River over in on the border of Georgia and South Carolina, all the way over to the Black Warrior River, which is the western edge of the Mobile drainage. So, and like shoal bass are in at the Apalachicola River drainage. Smallmouth bass down here anyway are native only to the Tennessee River drainage. The I can't say it's newly described, but it's on the cusp of being newly described species of bass called the Choctaw bass that's being headed up by some scientists down in Florida. That's a fish that looks a lot like a spotted bass, but when you actually look at the distribution, it's kind of cut off from the rest of the spotted bass range by the Mobile drainage, which the native form there is the Alabama bass, what we used to call Alabama spotted bass, that's been elevated to a species. The Choctaw bass basically is found in all the streams that flow into the Gulf from between the Mobile drainage and the Apalachicola drainage. And it's possible that the same kind of thing might be going on the other side of the Mobile drainage between that and the Mississippi drainage. So the wide range of bass species specifically down here does seem to fall out among drainages. And we have a wide variety of drainages in this part of the world.
As we've mentioned already a few times, that you work with shoal bass a little bit. So how are these fish different from largemouth or smallmouth bass? Or could you describe them to someone who might have never seen one?
A shoal bass looks somewhat superficially like a smallmouth bass. Before it was described, a lot of the local anglers in Georgia used to call it a Georgia smallmouth or a Flint River smallmouth. Now, I say superficially because if the truth is that if you held one in one hand and one in the other, the differences would be quite noticeable. But they do tend to be on the brown side, although not as brown as smallmouth bass. They often have vertical barring, like smallmouth bass do, but not quite to the same degree. They are really, in truth, more of a greenish gold color with black markings instead of a more brown with black markings. They definitely have a larger mouth on average than a smallmouth bass would. So when you're looking at them, they kind of have this characteristics of several different species. Like I mentioned, they do somewhat look like a smallmouth. They also have some horizontal rows of spotting on their sides below the lateral line, like some spotted bass can. They have a very dark basal spot at the base of the tail that's very noticeable, particularly when they're swimming underwater. As far as visually, that's how they look different. When you think of them in a biological sense, they're really different. This is a fish, a very rare black bass, that is what I think more of as a big river fish. This is a fish that spawns in rocky shoal-like areas with fast flow. These areas typically have high gradient, large chunk rock, can be very big in size, on the order of like a mile long and maybe 300 meters wide. And the fish form spawning aggregations. They literally migrate to these areas and pile in them, kind of like what big river fish would do, like a paddlefish or a sturgeon, or if you want to get a little less charismatic, like a lot of large river suckers do. But we've seen fish move as much as 200 kilometers to reach these areas in the Flint River over in Georgia. They congregate in these areas, they spawn, they form nests, although they're not nests that you can typically see. They're not like these beautiful little circles in sand or fine gravel like you see with largemouths and smallmouths, and even spotted bass to some degree do that. Instead, they kind of form them just basically on flat rocks or areas in right behind obstructions, flow refugia, if you will, which is really interesting. Some folks down in Florida actually are working on a spring-fed river called the Chipola, and which is a tributary to the Apalachicola. They have some really cool spawning video of these fish right out in the middle of the river, basically spawning behind a clump of vallisneria. And the video is quite striking because you can see that with the vegetation flowing in the current, you can see how fast the current is. And right behind at the base of that plant, there's an area that's about the size of a bowling ball or so that's no current. And that's where the fish is sitting right there spawning. And that is really odd for a nest building species of black bass, which we would really more associate with spawning on the fringes of a river or in backwaters or in eddies or in stuff like that. That's not what these guys do. After they spawn, they redistribute throughout the river until the next year. And so that's obviously really different than what most black bass species do. They are very fast-growing fish. That's one thing that sets them apart from smallmouth bass in terms of thinking of smallmouth bass across their range. In the Flint River, these things actually grow faster than largemouth bass, can reach 16 inches in maybe about 4 years, can reach 20 inches in about 6 to 7 years. And if you translate that into what does that mean for anglers, it means that 4-pound shoal bass are not that uncommon, and 5-pounders are almost expected when you're fishing in the spring. And I don't know very many smallmouth bass fisheries that produce fish like that on a regular basis. Their ultimate size is actually probably a little smaller than smallmouth bass, although there's so few fisheries that smallmouth bass reach 10 pounds, but they can. The biggest shoal bass on record is 8 pounds and 12 ounces caught out of the Apalachicola River in Florida. Truthfully, it seems like very few fish reach 7. And since I've been studying the shoal bass in 2006, I think, is when we started, I only have seen one angler caught shoal bass that exceeded 8 pounds, and no sampled shoal bass that exceeded 8 pounds. But the odd thing is that 6 is not that uncommon. So there's some break there between 6 and 7 where a lot of fish just don't make that. But still, that's a very impressive sized bass for a river fish. So yeah, they're actually quite a different animal. And the more we study them, the more different they look.
I think it's obvious that you're very knowledgeable about the shoal bass, and that was probably one of the reasons why you were chosen or decided to write the range-wide shoal bass management plan. And like we mentioned, that outlines future conservation, also restoration of the species. So restoration usually means that there's some sort of decline, but you just alluded that there's a lot of 6-pound fish in this fishery. Are there some other smaller tributaries that need their populations restored?
So for those not familiar with the Apalachicola drainage, it's a fairly good size drainage. I believe it's somewhere in the neighborhood of like 23 or 24,000 square miles. It basically has two main rivers. It kind of looks like almost a wishbone. You have the Flint River in the east and the Chattahoochee River in the north and west, and they've come together to form the Apalachicola River. And so that is, in essence, the Apalachicola River drainage. So the Flint River that I was talking about earlier, that's one of the more pristine rivers in the eastern part of the United States, certainly in the southeastern United States. It has basically just two dams on it, and they actually happen to be within about 15 or 20 river miles of each other. So above that is a reach of undammed river that is about 320 kilometers long, which makes it one of only 40 rivers in the United States that has that kind of undammed reach. And then because those two dams are so close together, you have another reach below it that's 125 or roughly kilometers that are it's undammed. It is affected by hydropeaking flows, but it is undammed until it reaches the headwaters of Lake Seminole. And it also happens to be very rural. It's a very rural watershed. There's maybe 650,000-700,000 people that live in that entire watershed. On the other side is the Chattahoochee River, and no rivers in one watershed could probably be any different than the Chattahoochee and the Flint. So the Chattahoochee actually originates up in the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains, and it flows through Atlanta, Georgia. From there, it flows southwest till it reaches, till it turns suddenly south and becomes the state line between Alabama and Georgia. And it runs all the way down that line until it reaches the headwaters of Lake Seminole. At one point, it had 13 dams on it. So the entire river has been very chopped up, if you will. Particularly the coastal plain part of the river, where estimates are that basically about 97% of the river that was in the coastal plain is now impounded. The fall line part of the river, and over in this part of the country, we have three physiographic provinces that really dictate the geomorphology of the rivers and streams. We have the Piedmont, which is that upper part of there, the rolling hills, if you will, a lot of clay in the soil, granite shoals, stuff like that, granite rocks. And then you have the coastal plain, which is the lowest part, and that's sandy. If there's any rocks at all, it's probably limestone. The rivers are very sinuous. And then you have that region between them, which is called the fall line. And the fall line is basically the shoreline of the ancient ocean that was here a long time ago. And so it's a point where you have high gradient, a lot of exposed rocks, and that's why it gets the name. Literally, the rivers fall off the Piedmont into the coastal plain along this stretch. And it's usually about anywhere from 30 to 50 miles wide. And it stretches across Alabama and Georgia. And it actually goes, those same provinces go up the Atlantic slope as well through the Carolinas and Virginia and all of that. Because of that gradient, that is a great place for these fish, right? I mean, they like that kind of habitat. And that was a natural place for that habitat to be. It also is a fantastic place to build hydro dams because you already have the gradient there. And when we think about that, we're thinking really like old hydro dams. I mean, nowadays we can build a hydro dam pretty much anywhere. Back 150 years ago, you would use the geography and the geology, if you will, to your advantage. And so as early as the mid-1800s, even a little before that, the people in that area had started to put dams up on these rivers in that reach to grind corn or to run cotton gins, or just a little bit later on, as Industrial Revolution occurred, to actually power mills. There wasn't a grid down here back then. If you wanted power, you had to do it yourself. And so that part of the Chattahoochee happens to be a place where a lot of people live. And so as early as the mid-1800s, there was already multiple dams there that inundated habitat and stopped that migration that we now know these fish do if there's no dams. And then they just kept growing as our technology got better and better. And so the bottom line is that as of like 2010, there were 8 dams in a 45-mile stretch of river on the Chattahoochee, which was all the best part of the shoal bass habitat, basically extirpated. This is a fish. Also, I guess I should have mentioned this when you asked me about how are they different from smallmouth. This is an obligate river fish. If you put up a reservoir, they don't live there. They don't want anything to do with it. And so not only do you block migrations, you also take away habitat because they won't live in your reservoir. Even if it has a decent amount of flow, they still don't live there. And so in the Chattahoochee River, between all the damming that went on, and then, of course, there's a lot more people. You have Atlanta. There's 6 million people that live in Atlanta, which is like twice the number that live in the entire state of Alabama. And then farther downstream, you have West Point, Georgia. You have Columbus, Georgia, which is also a fairly large city. And so all in all, you have, like I said earlier, maybe 750,000 people that live in the entire Flint River drainage, and you probably have somewhere in the neighborhood of maybe as much as 10 times that in the Chattahoochee. And all of that urbanization and all of that impoundment and all has taken its toll on shoal bass. And so when we think about restoration of shoal bass, that is the place where these fish are on life support. The Chattahoochee River is, I don't remember exactly, but I want to say roughly about 700 kilometers long. And in an entire stretch of river, there's probably about a half a dozen populations that we know of currently extant. One is, not surprisingly, in the small stretch of the Chattahoochee above the highest dam, Lake Lanier, the only part of the Chattahoochee that's what you would call natural, although it's under a lot of stresses because people from, well, first of all, I mean, Atlanta's growing, and that's one direction it's growing in. But also, people from Atlanta, understandably so, like to go to the mountains and all that. And so it tends to be a good place to build houses or build vacation homes or whatever. And so that's all right up there where the Chattahoochee is. So it's getting more urbanized all the time. Once you get in downtown Atlanta, the Chattahoochee is lovely, but it's mostly a trout stream there because of the hypomimetic releases. And then once you get downstream of Atlanta, there is a 70-mile stretch of river, roughly, that doesn't seem to have them in there, and we don't know why. We are hoping to put them back in there at some point. And you have a host of tributary streams. We did a project there 5 or 6 years ago where we surveyed all the larger tributary streams and found only 3 populations south of Atlanta. And they're in 2 real close to Auburn and 1 up, ironically, up near Atlanta in a state park. And we found at least 4 streams that we knew had shoal bass in them as recently as 20 years ago that don't now. So this is an ongoing problem. In the Chattahoochee proper below or in the fall line area, there are several isolated populations shoal bass that are found right below dams, but they're stuck. It's like a fly in a bottle situation. They won't swim downstream into the reservoir below there, and they obviously can't get over the dam. And so you have these fish that are stuck in a 1 or 2 kilometer stretch of river, and that's it. And so you can only produce so many fish in that kind of scenario. So that's kind of how all this started, if you will. It's funny how big research projects or initiatives, if you will, can start on the smallest things. And it really was a very small thing. At Alabama, because of geography and where the Chattahoochee drainage shows up in Alabama and our hydrology over here, we only had about 4 or 5 rivers where shoal bass ever were. And back in 2005, my old advisor, Mike Messina, got a project from the state to just go see what's going on in those rivers because, quite frankly, no one really has been looking for the last 40 years. And so we're just kind of hearing that maybe they're not doing so well. And so he went in there with a grad student, and I was really only working tangentially on that project. I had my own things going on at that point. And the 4 rivers that formerly had shoal bass in them, only one of them still did. And that was a small stretch of just shoal habitat in about 600 meters long between 2 impassable drops, even for shoal bass, like a 10-meter high waterfall. And all the other streams were full of spotted bass, which are not native to the Apalachicola. They had been introduced as early as the 50s. So that got a lot of people's attention because here is a bass. Here's a bass that basically almost went extinct from a state with no one looking. And so that kind of got people's attention, right? I mean, you know, we don't think of bass in terms of conservation very often. If you're outside their native range, especially out in the western United States and Northwest, they're being actively extirpated because of the threats against native salmon and stuff like that, or certainly in other countries. So we don't ever think about black bass. We're like, black bass can live anywhere. They're a very tolerant species. But when you examine something, sometimes you find out that maybe you're wrong. And as Mike was wrapping up that project, somebody found spotted bass showing up in the Flint River, in that undammed, beautiful stretch of the Flint River that basically holds the largest population of this fish in the world. And so Georgia got very nervous about that, understandably so. We didn't know anything about this fish at this point, nothing. And so that's when they came to me and wanted to do a pretty comprehensive project on the Flint River to assess the threat of spotted bass to this fish. And at the same time, the state of Mike was actually winding things down, getting ready to retire. The state of Alabama came to me and wanted to do another 2 years on these streams to look to try to evaluate a restocking effort and all that. So I literally went from having never worked on this fish at all to having two projects going on at the same time in two different states in two different areas of the Apalachicola River drainage. And we learned an awful lot in a short amount of time, but we also learned that there's a lot we don't know. And so it just fed off each other. And yes, it culminated in me being asked to write the Shoal Bass Management Plan after, at that point, 10 years of a lot of research that has gone on to summarize what we know about the fish, to summarize what we know about the distribution of this fish, and to assess the threats and to try to come up with a game plan about how to protect what we have and how to restore what we don't. And that's kind of where we are right now. That's initiative is really just getting off the ground, if you will. But it's been quite an interesting and wild ride.
And you mentioned all the dams along the Chattahoochee River. And in your email to me, you mentioned that one of the topics you could cover was what not to do when removing a dam or a main stem dam. And as soon as I read that topic, I thought, I better bring that one up. It sounds like it's got a pretty interesting story to go along with it.
Yeah. So I said that as of 2010, there were 8 dams in the fall line area of the river. And I specified that because a few years later, so there's these really old mill dams on the Chattahoochee River that were basically right in downtown Columbus, Georgia. There's a smaller town on the Alabama side called Phoenix City. So literally, this river's got urban mania on both sides of it right there. And those dams had not been generating power for years. And they're old. Like the lowest most one, the concrete structure that was there, I believe, was built in 1869 or 1870. It was shortly after the Civil War. Now, there was an earlier structure that they found later above that dated from the 1850s. So that area's been dammed up for a long time. And the one above it was a few years newer. It was like, 1870 something. But they hadn't been generating power for a long time. And there had been a slow but steady building initiative to get rid of them. It's funny. My perspective of this is that this was a city-driven initiative by a group of interested citizens who were looking at this more economically than it was ecologically. And it's understandable that a lot of us, and I say us, I will include myself in that group, although I had very little input prior to their removal. A lot of us were like, yeah, whatever, get them out, that's fine. But I mean, the truth is that right below the lowest dam is pretty much the headwaters of Lake Eufaula, Walter F. George, a huge mainstem reservoir. And then there's another mill dam right above the other one. So it's like you're freeing up like 2 miles of river, and it's all urban, and there's no streams that flow into there. So while we are always like, yeah, let's get rid of the dams, if they're obsolete, let's get rid of them for sure. It wasn't like there were tons of people waiting on the edge of their seat to see what might happen. that this is going to turn into some giant biodiversity garden because we got rid of those two. So we were kind of like, yeah, on the sidelines cheering, yeah, let's do it. But we weren't, I don't think that there were really any natural resource agency taking a serious interest in what might happen there, other than it was like, well, we were really hoping it would turn into a nice shoal bass fishery that would be right downtown. But what the city was looking to do was to turn this into an urban whitewater course. And that was the initiative that was driving the dam removals. The city, a group of folks in the city formed their own corporation, got money, and bought the dams from the people who had it, and then literally did all the permitting, got the money to get rid of them, and took care of it. And these were people who were investing in the riverfront part. There was a river walk that runs along the Columbus side of the river that had actually been constructed during the 96 Olympics that were held in Atlanta. Turns out a few of the events were held down in Columbus, and so they got a chunk of money from the Olympics to renovate some of that area down there to make it, somewhat attractive to people coming to see whatever the events were. But so that was there. But most of the rest of that downtown, like when I moved here in 2000, you know, you didn't go downtown Columbus, at least not without, you know, personal armor and bodyguards, you know, and you sure didn't go down there after night, after dark. But the city's planners wanted to eliminate, they wanted to get rid of that culture, and they wanted to turn downtown Columbus, which is very historic, into something really cool. And they wanted it to be anchored by this whitewater course. So to make a long story short, all that came to fruition exactly the way they envisioned it. They got rid of the dams. They turned that thing into a whitewater course that is just fabulous from what I understand. The downtown got super revitalized. It is awesome. It is really cool now. People go to downtown Columbus all the time to go do the shopping and the eating and walk along the river and all that. So that's all been great. Part of the requirements, as even though these were dams that not a whole lot of people were super interested in their removal, they still have to go through the permitting process. And so part of the permitting process required them to do some monitoring, some pre-monitoring and some post-monitoring. And I got involved in the post-monitoring. I wasn't involved in the pre, but I had been down there before as part of one of our Alabama shoal bass projects earlier than this. I wanted to know what was below all those dams. So we got our boats in there, which was always exciting, in and out of ramps and driving down river walks and all that fun stuff. So I kind of knew what they was like down there, but I did a formal 3-year monitoring afterwards. And I can just say as an aside that sampling for fish in a whitewater course is a whole new brand of excitement and terror, especially considering that there's a hydro dam up above. So when those horns sound, it's time to leave, like yesterday. But it turns out that if you take out dams, but you want to have it as a really exciting whitewater course, you probably aren't like removing the barriers very well. And so that seems to be the case here, because they did remove the lower dam. I mean, that structure is gone, but this is the falls of the Chattahoochee. It's the bottom of the fall line. There's a lot of natural relief there anyway. And they had heavy equipment in the riverbed itself, moving rocks all around, making the course, literally, like digging it up and making the course, which of course that part of the Chattahoochee has been, like I mentioned, has been altered by man for probably 200 years. So it's not like they were in Yellowstone National Park doing this. So, you know, it's like, okay, well, whatever. I mean, at least the dams are gone. But it turns out that the bottom of that whitewater course was left as a very exciting drop that you know, the kinds that have the names. And it was so exciting that when they first started going there, they brought in whitewater experts from Eastern Tennessee to run the course there. And it had them for lunch. I mean, people were getting thrown out of the rafts and rafts were flipping and they had to modify the course a little bit to make it less dangerous. But if you're at the bottom of that and you're looking up, it don't look a whole lot different than it did when the dam was there. And turns out that, yeah, the fish community below the dam is still the most diverse. It gets a lot of fish that run up from the bigger reservoir that congregate below there, fish that you would think would be able to navigate through that, like large sucker species and shad and stuff like that. But when you go above that drop and all the way, that 2 miles all the way up to the next dam, none of those species are found there. It looks exactly the same as it did before the dams were there, mostly a bunch of sunfish and some spotted bass and a shoal bass here and there. And it was quite interesting because you see all these success stories of, oh, we removed this dam and like the day after the fish are swimming up past the dam. But apparently there is a way to take dams out and not remove the barrier. And we successfully made that happen in the Chattahoochee in Columbus. I should mention too that a lot of the water gets shunted through this one chute, and to make sure that it was really exciting for everybody. They installed a mechanical wave shaper in that chute, which you can't see at all. But fortunately, thanks to the internet, somebody was there taking pictures of it when they were putting it in there. And it's basically, if you can imagine it, it's like, it looks like a waterfall weir that you would go by to put in a pond to create a waterfall. It's like this solid metal wall that comes up, and then there's this hydraulic weir-like thing that comes out that apparently you can change from top to bottom, although you have to do it underwater. It's not mechanical, but you can actually change the way it shoots the water up there. And that was an eye-opener for me. And that was several years after I started, because I was like, why are these fish not getting over this thing? But, if it's a fish that follows along the bottom, it's going to operate very similar to like what a lock does, where they have those big concrete lips that's just a vertical wall. And so fish like Alabama shad or something like that can swim over them into a lock and be locked through. But a fish like a sturgeon that goes along the bottom just hits this giant wall and is like screwed. And that's got to be what's going on there too, because it literally is a solid steel wall that is not, it's even worse than a lock because there's a roof, which is that weir. So if you follow that shoreline, you're going to hit that and there's nowhere to go. So I'm not sure exactly what's going on there, but we've been surprised. We've had several floods already where the Riverwalk's gone underwater. All that stuff I just mentioned is underwater, and yet the fish still won't go up above it. So, it's not a national tragedy, because this wasn't a place where fish passage was really going to be important. But it was kind of surprising. I don't think any of us expected that. We didn't expect, like I said, we didn't expect this to turn into a biodiversity garden. But we thought we would at least get the suckers and the cats and the blue catfish and stuff like that over the drops, and it doesn't look like even them are making it over there. So yeah, that was a part we thought was something was gonna happen, and we're kind of left like eh. And at the same time, the shoal bass just vanished from that reach, and that's another one of those like why. Well, one of the most frustrating things about working on a fish that no one's worked on before, and almost no one, and you yourself have, if you think about how long people have been working on largemouth and smallmouth bass, yeah, I've been working on this fish for like 10 years. That's just a drop in the bucket. So we run into these things all the time where we're like, well, why'd this happen? And there's just a lot of blank looking at you around the table. So we don't know why the fish disappeared from that reach either, but that's not what we were expecting. So we're now in the process of trying to restock the fish to at least get an urban shoal bass fishery in there with the whitewater, of course, which would be pretty cool.
Well, it certainly sounds like an interesting scenario to be a part of.
Yeah, and it's great because it's 45 miles from campus.
Have you gone down the whitewater course in anything other than your electrofishing boat or sampling gear?
No, I have not. No, I guess I should one of these days, but no, I've had a couple students that have done it. They report it's great fun. Yeah, I've got PTSD from being in there with their electrofishing equipment, so I'm not sure I'm ready for not sure I'm ready for that. But it's pretty interesting though. I mean, it is when they built it, I believe they said it was one of the longest urban whitewater courses in the world. And it is completely urban. They put you in about 100 yards downstream of the lower, what is now the lowest dam in the fall line area there. And you run right through the middle of downtown. Well, it's two towns, like I said, on either side, because it's a different state on either side, but still you're going down an urban thing. And, on the Alabama or the Georgia side in particular, it's pretty neat because they left all of the old mill buildings, which again are, 150 years old with all that old brickwork and all, and they've restored them and they're turning them into condos and high end restaurants and stuff like that. So all that's still there. And so you do have a sense of, you're on this river that was a working river. And, it's not wild. It's not natural, although it's really cool with all the rocks and the shoals that are there. But you feel like you're in history, there. And so that part's neat. Like I said, it's not too neat trying to maneuver. We were actually using electrofishing setups out of canoes. It's the only thing we really could get in there. And maneuvering that through a whitewater course, you know, you have to know which parts of it you can run and which parts of it you will die if you try. And so you have to like then line the canoes and the equipment through it and pull them over rocks and don't fall in and, you know, all that good stuff. So, but that's Joel Best sampling pretty much everywhere for the most part. So, Joel Best fishing is not for the meek.
Well, Steve, thank you for filling us all in on the work that you're doing and have done with Shoal Bass. But now the tough part of the interview is over, as we are down to the final five questions. And this is a group of five questions I ask each of the guests that come on the show. And we always start real simple with, what is your favorite fish?
My favorite fish? Well, my favorite fish is whichever one's on the end of my fishing line at the time. But yeah, I couldn't pick just one though, because I play the field. I certainly enjoy shoal bass fishing, especially in the spring when they're piled up in those shoals. They're super aggressive. They strike really big topwater lures with very savage abandon. That is really cool. Red eye fishing is in the summer is so neat because it's kind of like brook trout fishing in these beautiful little mountainy like streams. But I mean, I also love going up north and fishing for smallmouth bass and in the Canadian wilderness and going down to Mexico and fishing for groupers and stuff like that on the Sea of Cortez. So I can't really pick one in terms of my fishing and working. Shoal bass has been pretty cool, I have to say. I mean, it's pretty cool because you just never know what you're going to find with those guys. But anyway.
And what is your favorite memory from your career so far?
Oh, my favorite memory from my career. I'm sure whatever I say is probably going to be wrong. My career at this point is getting distressingly long, which means I'm getting old. Gosh. I would say my favorite memory that immediately springs into mind, which I mean, I hate being so recent because like I said, I'm probably shortchanging stuff earlier in my career, but I distinctly remember the moment when we realized that shoal bass were so different. And it was another one of those things where we weren't looking for it, but it found us. And so I was doing an exploitation study on these fish in the Flint River. We wanted to know who's catching these fish, how many of them get harvested, the usual questions, you know, and they were at that time managed with a 12-inch limit, which is awfully low. And so we went out and tagged a lot of fish, and yeah, that's another whole story of adventures when you have 45 miles of a river that's completely inaccessible by anything but a canoe, doing a tagging study on that scale. And so we tagged fish up and down the river, and I'll never forget the first spring after that. Now, remember, at this point, we didn't know anything about the fish, really. A prelude to that was my grad student was doing telemetry work. And so we tagged him in the fall. And this would have been of 2007. We tagged him in the fall. The fish were, we did three species all at the same time, which is pretty rare. And I'm really proud that we did that. I'd love to do it again. Co-occurring species. We did largemouth bass, spotted bass, and shoal bass all at the same time. They all had radio tags, all tagged in the same part of the river. And he was tracking them all simultaneously to see how they interacted with each other and what they did. And so he was finding them every 2 weeks and everything was fine. And I remember him coming to my office after his first trip in March and said, all the shoal bass are gone. And I'm like, huh? Gone? What do you mean gone? It's like, they're all gone. I'm like, well, where'd they go? I have no idea. And so then we found out that every one of them had picked up and moved 10 miles downstream to this giant shoal and they were spawning down there. And then they came back later. And we had a few fish that went even further than that. We were in airplanes, couldn't find them and all that. So, you know, at that point we're like, wow, this fish is really weird. It moves like 10 miles and all, you know. Well, the following spring, so we had started the exploitation study that summer of 2008, And everything up till then, fish, people were catching them, you know, like within sight of where we were tagging them. You know, typical bass, right? Everything's normal. And then I remember distinctly the following March, and I would start taking these phone calls because they all had my office line was on the tag. So I got to talk to every one of these anglers, which was so cool. And this guy's catching this, he catches fish. I'm like, oh, wow, you catch it. I caught it up here. Okay, that's cool. You know, and then I'd hang up the phone, and I'd look up the fish. And I'm like, holy crap, we tagged that fish 60 miles downstream where that guy caught it. And the next guy calls, and he's like, I caught this fish here. And then at this point, I'm like, okay, let me look it up while I'm on the phone with you. Oh, that fish was caught 70 miles downstream. And it was that way the whole spring. And by the end of the spring, I had fish that were 150 miles upstream of where I'd tagged them. I'm like, holy mackerel. And that it's hard to replicate that, you know? I mean, it's just like no one had any idea. It's so rare in our field to get to work on something that literally no one had ever worked on before and to find out something like that. So I guess that's probably my favorite memory just because it was, you know, so unique. I can't claim any credit because I wasn't even trying to find that stuff out when we started this thing. And that makes it even better because I never claimed to be brilliant.
Well, it sounds like you're really having fun with all those projects down there at Auburn. And so perhaps this is it, but what is your dream job or dream location to work in?
That's something that probably would have changed through my life, honestly, but it's hard to beat this area here. If you like black bass, and if you are fascinated by diversity of black bass, then it would be hard to find a place better situated than literally Auburn. I mean, you know, like, you know, of course, Alabama and Georgia is where you'd want to be, right? Because, I mean, I think Georgia has like 9 species of bass, and Alabama might also have 9 species of bass if some of this red eye stuff works out. But for those of you folks who don't know, and I certainly didn't know where the heck Auburn was before I moved here, but Auburn lies like 30 miles from the Georgia line. And so I have people that come, I invite people all the time, and some of them take me up on it. But literally, you know, in terms of either working on them or if you're fishermen like I am, I tell people, you could come here for 3 days, and we could literally catch 8 species of bass in a 2-hour radius of the campus. That's pretty freaking cool. It's hard to beat that. You know, if you were over in like Athens, which is also a great place, you have about half of that because you're in Georgia and you're way over in Georgia. But here, because we're right on the cusp, I mean, I can drive 2 hours in Georgia and have a whole different suite of species than if I drive 2 hours to the west in Alabama. So that's really neat. So it's been quite an experience that I've really come to appreciate over the last 10 years that if you'd asked me before then, I don't know if I would have truly understood that, but it is really neat to have all these different species around you and to literally, you know, try to see in a year, every year I kind of tallied up at the end of the year, you know, how many species of bass did I catch this year? And it's usually somewhere between 7 and 8, more, maybe more if I want to go down on the panhandle of Florida and look for Swanee bass or something like that. And of course, professionally speaking, being located that close to all these species, it gives you opportunities to have research on some of them. And, you know, if you can get buy-in from funders or whatever. And so I've been very fortunate in my career between working in Tennessee before here and now here that I've probably now done research on somewhere in the neighborhood of about 7 species of black bass. And I'll be knocking another one off next year when we start on the warrior red-eye bass over there. So it's kind of neat. You know, I've basically become a black bass biologist primarily. Occasionally they let me work on other things, but still the sheer location of where Auburn University is, it has really afforded me great opportunities to work and not in one state. That's another neat thing is that I work regularly in Georgia and in Alabama and get to rub shoulders with a wide variety of professionals in different walks of life. So it's been really great.
And you mentioned you've been kind of cornered as the black bass guy now, but if money was not an issue, what is one project that you would like to work on?
Oh, boy. I'm sure if I thought about it, I could come up with a very, very clever and different answer. But the funny thing is that there is such a project that's been on my bucket list, if you will, for ever since the end of 2011, when we finished that tagging study on shoal bass, which was, again, an exploitation study. And so I'm going to have to say that, because that's the one that I want to do. I really have thought about this. It's going to be hard. Well, not I want to say hard, but it's going to take a fair amount of money. And so it's been like, I've been afraid to even try to convince someone that we need to do this. But we want to do what I call the quintessential shoal bass telemetry project on that large undammed stretch of the Flint River, which would be like literally tagging maybe as many as 100 to 200 fish with radio tags, with 2 or 3 year radio tags, and follow these fish around to really see what they do. The problem with the old telemetry or the old tagging study is that the anglers clip the tags off after they catch them, so the record ends. So you don't know for sure if the fish was getting caught in transit, or if that's where he was hanging out. What did he did afterwards? We don't know any of that stuff. We just kind of infer what goes on. That would be a study that you could actually really tell what's going on. I mean, what we're dealing with here is a patagromous black bass, which is crazy, right? I mean, so that study could really, really show insights that would be pretty unique to the genus, I think. So it would be a really cool study, and I hate to use the same old species that I've been studying as the answer to that question, because I'm sure if I really thought about it, I could come up with others. But that has been on the bucket list or the wish list for at least 10 years now, and I'm hoping someday before I retire, we can make that happen, because I think it would be really cool.
And finally, if there was one point or one principle that you could have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
I'm going to go way off the board here, which I'm sure you'll like, because we've been talking a lot about bass and shoal bass and all that. Something that I see as a concern, I won't go to problem. A concern that I have is an increasing emphasis in our field over projects that are only or can only be tangentially linked to management of our resources. And some of that's driven by the departments themselves in universities. Some of that is being forced down their throat by administrators who want them to go get the sexy NSF funding or do these global projects and all that. And that's fine. But what I'm seeing happen here, and I'm saying that as someone who's been in this field for sadly almost 25 years now, and who was raised, if you will, raised a much different way than a lot of people are raising their students today. We're seeing a disenfranchisement of the state agencies specifically from the university research process in a lot of cases that I find distressing. And I guess I would say, remember that the states have the regulatory power. They are the regulatory agencies, and none of your research matters if they can't use it. It doesn't matter in terms of changing things if they can't use it. I should say that, because I mean, all research matters, but does it matter beyond your interests? Does it matter beyond, this is really cool what I found out? You know, research that actually makes a difference is something that a regulatory agency, which is primarily a state. Now, if you work in the marine realm, it's actually more primarily federal. But if you're inland, the primary regulatory agency, unless it's an endangered species, is a state agency somewhere. And if they can't take what you're doing and use it to make their job better or to understand their resource better, then, you know, you have to wonder, what are you doing then? Is what you're doing helping them at any rate? And I mean, not all of us have to do that, right? But some of us do. And what I'm seeing is more and more the universities are going off and doing their own thing and leaving the states behind. And that's a problem because A, the states not either has to do the work themselves or the work's just not getting done. And B, when it comes time for them to hire employees, the students are not getting that background that they get when they're working on a project that's of interest to a state agency. And they know coming into it what a state agency is and how they work and what management stuff is. And I hear this a lot. I rub shoulders with a lot of chiefs of fisheries and other administrators. And there is a general feeling from a lot of agencies, especially in the Southeast, that they're being left behind and they're being forced to pick people who are, you know, the best qualified out of a pool of non-qualified people. And so, you know, I guess I just wanted to mention that, you know, we need to make sure that at least some of our research, if not a lot of our research, is of use to state agencies, because they're the ones that are going to institute the changes that we might think are needed. And I won't go on any longer than that, because that could be another whole podcast.
Yeah, that would make for a good roundtable podcast episode. Well, Steve, thank you again for coming on the podcast today. It was a pleasure hearing about you and the work you're doing down there at Auburn with all the different black bass species you've been fortunate enough to work on. If people want to find out more information or get a hold of you, what would be the best way to do that?
Oh, goodness. They can certainly find me here at Auburn. My email address is samosm@auburn.edu. That would be samosm@auburn.edu. We have a Black Bass Conservation Committee Facebook page that has all kinds of pictures and cool things of different bass and what's going on around the country in black bass restoration. I co-manage that page. So a lot of the content you see there is from me. So you can also contact me through that.
And if you would like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter @FisheriesPod, on Facebook @facebook.com/FisheriesPodcast, or old-fashioned email feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. You can download and subscribe to receive future episodes on your favorite listening app or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. I am Nick Kramer, and thank you for listening to the 47th episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember to remember the state agencies in your research.